This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Haiti Adams-Fitzpatrick, coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We put out an annual report that measures the use of contraception in the 69 lowest income countries of the world. We put this report out every year. So this year, we've measured that in these 69 countries, there are now almost 310 million women and girls who have access to and are using modern forms of contraception.
That's Beth Schlachter, Executive Director of Family Planning 2020. We'll have full details on this story coming up.
Also, 14 UN peacekeepers have been killed in the DRC. Prominent analysts say the new administration will not be different in Zimbabwe from the one it replaced. And the International Organization for Migration reports it has begun repatriating the first 4,000 African migrants detained in Libya.
We'll have these stories and more just ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has expressed his outrage after an attack on UN peacekeepers in the eastern DRC that killed at least a dozen Tanzanian peacekeepers and injured 40 more.
And I want to express my outrage and utter heartbreak at last night's attack on the United Nations peacekeepers in the DRC. Early indications from the site of the attack in North Kivu indicate that at least 12 Tanzanian peacekeepers were killed and at least 40 injured, four of them critically. And we also understand that at least five members of the armed forces of the Democratic Republic of Congo were killed. I offer my deepest condolences to the families and loved ones of the victims and to the government and people of Tanzania. And I wish a speedy recovery to all those injured. I condemn this attack unequivocally. And these deliberate attacks against UN peacekeepers are unacceptable and constitute a war crime.
That was United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres. A UN official told VOA that the attack on the mission's forward operating base in Semaliki in Beni territory was likely perpetrated by the Ugandan rebel group, the Allied Democratic Forces, which is active in the area and has attacked the mission in the past month. DRC government spokesman Lambert Mende says his government also thinks ADF forces are responsible. The peacekeepers were part of a special intervention force based in eastern Congo.
On the surface, it appears that a lot has changed in Zimbabwe in recent weeks. Longtime President Robert Mugabe finally resigned after 37 years in power, and a new president who has vowed to usher in a fresh era. But some Zimbabwean analysts doubt the new administration will be much different from the one it's replaced. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
New President Emmerson Mnangagwa has hailed his ascension as the dawn of a new era, and this week introduced a national budget that reverses some of the most notable and controversial economic policies created by his predecessor, Robert Mugabe. Not so fast, say prominent Zimbabwean analysts who argue that the new government is hardly a change at all. After all, the new president was for decades Mugabe's right-hand man. Kutukwashe Chitsike directs the Research and Advocacy Unit, a Zimbabwe-based think tank.
We've changed the driver, but it's the same bus. So what major difference is Mnangagwa going to bring for us? I don't see much change.
Ibo Mandaza, a prominent academic and author, says he's disappointed that the international community avoided describing the military-led action that prompted Mugabe's resignation as a coup. Calling it that, he said, might have brought in real change, like a more diverse cabinet with more opposition voices, not just ruling party stalwarts and military men in top positions.
Most of them, like SADC, like South Africa, would have wanted a transitional government. It's a way of disguising the coup. That has not happened at all. On the contrary, you have a reaccession, nay, an overaccession of the coup. The man who announced the coup, Sibusiso Somoye, is now Minister of Foreign Affairs and International Trade.
The analysts express concern that while Mnangagwa has promised to hold elections as planned in mid-2018, his close relationship with the military means the armed forces may try to influence the outcome. And so, just weeks after the most startling change Zimbabwe has seen in decades, Mandaza and other analysts are calling for even more change.
But given the new reality in which it's just change of the driver, and we have virtually military rule, I think it offers an opportunity for all of us, the region, the international community, together with the national situation, to demand a transitional government until reform, political and economic reforms are taken. Otherwise, I can't see how we can sustain the situation we have in Zimbabwe at the moment.
For a nation that has been through so much in the past few weeks and years, these are harsh words indeed. But analysts say change is never easy. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Thank you, Anita. The High Court in Harare today delayed the trial of an American woman accused of undermining the authority for former President Robert Mugabe. Martha O'Donovan's trial now is set to begin January 4th. O'Donovan denies the charges, which are based on a Twitter post the prosecutor says she sent. She was arrested early last month before the military took control of the government and Mugabe resigned. She currently is free on bail but not able to leave the country. O'Donovan works for Magamba TV, which produces satirical content. Family Planning 2020, a global partnership that empowers women and girls to decide for themselves how many children they want to have, released a new report this week that shows progress in the world's poorest countries. In its annual progress report, it was found that the use of modern contraception between July 2016 and July 2017 prevented 84 million unintended pregnancies, 26 million unsafe abortions, and 125,000 maternal deaths. Beth Schlachter, Executive Director of Family Planning 2020, spoke with me about the significance of the report.
We put out an annual report that measures the use of contraception in the 69 lowest income countries of the world. We put this report out every year. So this year, we've measured that in these 69 countries, there are now almost 310 million women and girls who have access to and are using modern forms of contraception. And that's about 38.8 million more than when we started measuring progress in 2012. So there's been some significant uptake.
Yes, that sounds very promising. So how are African women responding to the use of contraception?
So Africa was the region of the world that was farthest behind in terms of having access to comprehensive reproductive health programs and contraception in particular. So we've actually seen amazing growth in Africa relative to other regions. We still need to do a lot of work to make sure that we're providing more access to African women. But even though the population in Africa is much smaller compared to Asia, almost half of the growth that we're seeing is in African countries. So there are 16 million additional women and girls who are now able to use contraception in Africa, with South and East Africa growing faster.
Can you name some of the countries where they're using the contraception?
Yeah, well, it's actually across the continent where we've seen growth. There's another partnership that we work with that focuses on West African countries that have the lowest contraceptive rates, and that's where we've seen some amazing uptake in the last 5 or 6 years. They set a goal for themselves to increase by 1 million over a 5-year period, and they exceeded that ahead of time and are continuing to grow. So where we're seeing a lot of development indicators across the board, education, water and sanitation, all of those things that are very complicated, we see lower health rates as well. So that partnership focusing on the area where there's a lot of infrastructure work to do has seen really great growth.
How are women accessing the contraception, and what forms of contraception are they using?
So we try to make sure that women have a wide range of methods so that they're able to use short-term methods if they're looking to space their birth, so making sure that pills are available. We're looking particularly, though, to make sure that long-acting methods are available, and that's a sea change for women and girls. Injectables, and in particular, IUDs and implants, where if a woman wants to space or limit the number of children she has for a number of years, she can use one of these long-term methods and then just be assured that she safe. We also make sure that condoms are available in all places because we recognize the need for dual protection so that we're making sure that women can control when they get pregnant and that they're protected from sexually transmitted infections as well.
Are there any cultural barriers that are making the use of contraception more challenging?
Yes, cultural barriers, in fact, are some of the most persistent challenges that women face, not only in terms of knowing about contraception, but receiving contraception and being able to go there, having their families accept it, having the men in their lives, religious leaders, mothers-in-law accept it, but also when they go for the services themselves to ensure that all women and girls who feel they are in need of contraception can receive that. We've seen some amazing changes, however. One of the programs that we work with is the Gates Foundation has the Nigeria Urban Reproductive Health Initiative. And in northern Nigeria, what they found is that the number one and two reasons that women cite for not using contraception are that they believe that God will take care of whether or not they get pregnant, and they believe there are religious prohibitions against using contraception. So in working with religious leaders to provide information from core documents such as the Bible or the Quran and helping them to understand that there is an open space for this that's allowed with in religion, we've seen some of the resistance to that drop by rates as high as 50% when those messages come from religious leaders themselves. So culture, religion, family dynamics, all of those issues are really relevant to whether or not women can actually access and use contraception.
That was Beth Schlachter, Executive Director of Family Planning 2020. She spoke with me from Washington. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580, and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Heidi Adams-Fitzpatrick, and at 16 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres says he's outraged after an attack in eastern DRC leaves 14 UN peacekeepers dead. Prominent Zimbabwean analysts say the new administration will not be much different from the one it replaced. And the annual Family Planning 2020 Progress Report reveals more African women used contraception last year than ever before. For more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
The International Organization for Migration has begun the voluntary repatriation of thousands of West African migrants being held in detention centers in Libya under abusive conditions. Lisa Schlein reports from IOM headquarters in Geneva.
IOM plans to repatriate a total of 15,000 African migrants by the end of the year. Most come from Nigeria, Guinea, Mali, and Senegal. The government of Niger has agreed to act as a country of transit for the migrants. Those who arrive at the airport in Niamey are registered by the International Organization for Migration and transported to their homes of origin. An IOM charter flight carrying 504 Nigerians, including women and young children, arrived in Niamey on Thursday. IOM plans 7 additional daily charter flights from Tripoli, each carrying about 500 Nigerian migrants. The organization says another chartered flight arrived in Guinea's capital on Thursday, carrying 167 of the country's nationals. Agency spokesman Leonard Doyle says people are returning home in great distress after having endured months of torture, overcrowding, and other forms of ill treatment in the Libyan detention centers. Doyle tells VOA it is very difficult to stop African migrants from trying to reach Europe. He criticizes Facebook and other social media for allowing criminals to spread lies and entice young people to make this sometimes fatal journey.
We really, once again, ask social media companies to step it up and behave in a responsible way when people are being lured to their death, to their torture. Their families are being emasculated. The torture sessions are sent back to the families over WhatsApp, which I understand is also a Facebook tool.
Doyle says Facebook is interested in pushing its market share in Africa, which has a potential client base of 1 billion. But he says this should not be done in ways that are detrimental to young, vulnerable populations across West Africa and elsewhere, who, in seeking a better life, often become victims of gross violations of human rights. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Most children in sub-Saharan Africa are taught in a common colonial language instead of their mother tongue. Proponents say teaching in an international language is advantageous, but others argue that this can confuse children and affect their ability to learn. Sophia Christensen reports from Dakar, where experts want local languages integrated into the standard French curriculum.
In Aliosam Primary School, in a working-class section of Dakar, second graders are learning to read in French. Like most children in sub-Saharan Africa, they are taught in their country's common colonial language rather than in their mother tongue. Linguistics professor Mbaki Ndiang of Dakar Sheikh Anta Diop University wants to integrate local languages into the standard teaching curriculum.
Si l'enfant arrive à la première année de l'école élémentaire primaire,
he says most children entering primary school in Senegal have been functioning in Wolof for at least 7 years beforehand. They have structured their world in this language, he says. But as soon as they get to school, all this knowledge is set aside in order to impose French. Diagne and others believe this slows the learning process and can discourage children from pursuing education. According to Education Policy and Data Center statistics, Senegal's youth literacy rate is lower than the average for other lower middle income countries, and more than half of secondary school age children are out of school. Organizations such as the Associates in Research and Education for Development have been piloting bilingual teaching programs in Senegalese primary schools. Awa Kadia is the ARED program director. She explains that children start simultaneously learning French and building literacy skills in either Wolof or Pular, which are later used as a base to read in French. ARED currently operates in 98 primary schools spread between Dakar, the northern city of Saint-Louis, and the town of Kaolack. The pilot program ends this year, and DIA hopes results will encourage the government to fund an extended version, covering more regions and incorporating other local languages. But in Aliosam School, Headmaster Meissa Dieng has mixed feelings about teaching in Wolof. Speaking French in school will allow children to really master the language, he says. But then there is the psychological impact of deconstructing a thinking process that has already been established. And parents are often the first to oppose the idea. Literacy and education expert Chris Darby is with SIL, a non-profit serving language communities around the world. He says for 6 years, he struggled with community resistance to a multilingual education project in rural Senegal.
A lot of the resistance comes from parents as well as teachers and right the way up the hierarchy. But parents are very keen, I think, for children to succeed. And they tend to think of success as far as what a school can do in terms of delivering an international language.
Other countries also are delving into local languages. In 2014, the Ethiopian government and USAID launched a reading curriculum in 7 Ethiopian languages to improve reading skills. And in 2015, Tanzania introduced a policy to remove English as a medium of instruction and teach entirely in Kiswahili. But for Barbara Trudell, who is Director of Research and Advocacy for SIR Africa, favoring local languages in a multilingual context can be complicated.
As soon as you move from an international language down into an African national language, choosing one of those, the rivalries are instantly there. At least that is the thing about French, English, Portuguese, they're sort of seen to be on a different level.
In Senegal, Wolof is spoken by more than 80% of the population, but there are more than 20 national languages recognized by the government. In this context, this may be the greatest challenge to teaching in local languages. Sophia Christensen for VOA News, Dakar.
In South Africa, the High Court has ruled that President Jacob Zuma's appointment of a state prosecutor to decide whether to reinstate corruption charges against him is invalid. The court says the appointment of Sean Abrahams as the National Director of Public Prosecutions should be set aside immediately. In October, the Supreme Court of Appeal upheld an earlier decision by a lower court that the nearly 800 corruption charges filed against Zuma before he became president be reinstated. It then fell to Abrahams as public prosecutor to decide whether or not his agency should pursue a case against Zuma. The charges against Zuma relate to a $2 billion government arms deal arranged in the late 1990s and have amplified calls for Zuma to step down before his term as president ends in 2019. Zuma appointed Abrahams as chief state prosecutor in 2015. The court ruled that South Africa's deputy president, Cyril Ramaphosa, should appoint a new public prosecutor within 60 days.
The World Health Organization is warning that the number of people living with dementia globally will triple from 50 million to 152 million by 2050. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva, where the WHO is launching a global monitoring system on dementia, which will track progress and identify areas of concern.
The World Health Organization reports dementia exacts a huge social and economic burden, one that will grow as people age and succumb to this mental illness. The agency estimates 5% of the world's older population suffers from dementia and is in need of care. Belying common belief, WHO says this is not mainly a problem of rich countries, as dementia affects a larger number of people living in poorer countries. The health agency says the cost of caring for dementia patients today is $818 billion, or 1% of the world's gross domestic product. Taryn Dua is a medical officer in WHO's Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse. She says the economic cost will be more than $2 trillion by 2030.
Moreover, there is stigma, human rights violation associated with people with dementia and their caregivers, and therefore it is imperative that we have a public health response. An important step that has been taken by all member states has endorsing a global action plan on dementia this year.
She says the plan focuses on caring for people who have dementia, on preventing and on finding a cure for this illness. She says raising awareness of this problem is essential.
Many people consider that dementia is a normal part of aging, which is not true. We need to think about risking preventing dementia, because the risk factors for dementia are the same for non-communicable diseases. So good exercise, good diet, no tobacco, decreasing alcohol, all of this can decrease the risk of dementia.
Along with this, she says elderly people who suffer from depression should receive treatment for the malady. She says social inclusion and cognitive exercise are other strategies that should be employed to reduce the risk of dementia. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Haiti Adams-Fitzpatrick in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in, you will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA Africa.